All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Jim Fear 138 podcast. I have a very special guest this week. The one, the only, the eminent sage and howitzer operator himself, Daddy Warpig.
Howdy, folks.
And there was a topic that he wanted to talk about, but apparently neither of us knows what it is anymore.
Well, I know what it was, but it doesn't really necessarily matter anymore. I saw a whole lot of people getting really defensive over the Vox Day's first comic book. And they were like really going hardcore after the people who criticized it.
Oh, was that Quantum Mortis?
Yeah. But the person they were going after, Ethan Van Sciver, him and Vox did a live stream and kind of
hashed everything out.
Yeah, kind of hashed everything out. So it isn't necessarily important, but
I'm gonna have to watch that live stream. I thought that they had just kind of agreed to part ways, and see what happened in the future. But I'm glad that they did a live stream because they're kind of on the same side. So it seems kind of weird that they would be that combative, especially that Vox would be that combative with Ethan, because he's been in this business for God only knows how many years. So it kind of seems like, if Ethan's telling you, this is what you need to do with your comic books, he's kind of the guy to listen to, especially since nobody else is really out here doing what he's doing. No pros have YouTube channels that I know of.
What I saw was a lot of people they're saying things like, oh, he wants to be the John Scalzi, or he's trying to suck up to his SJW bosses or whatever. And I'm like, no, dude, that isn't it. I mean, the things you were saying were real problems with the book. It was not, it was not BS that he was just saying to get it out there. There are and have been, at least with Quantum Mortis, and I checked it out on Amazon. I didn't buy it. I checked it out on Kindle Unlimited, but I did read the whole thing. And there were some real problems with the book that, people were just saying, oh, no, this isn't a problem, or coming up with reasons why it wasn't going to be a problem or whatever. And I'm like, I'm not saying that absolutely everything he said was right, but I don't remember reading anything he said that was wrong, and none of it seemed like he was trying to reach just to tear it down or trying to insult people or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, he was a little bit – I did see his review of it. He was a little bit blunt, but, nothing that he said seemed particularly wrong. But I haven't read the comic book, so I don't really know. It just seems kind of weird that they were getting into this kind of head bashing contest for, like a week and a half or something, but I'm glad that they got a live stream together and kind of hashed it out.
Yeah. I think especially with the cultural rebellion that a lot of people are getting involved in, it is absolutely critical. Absolutely critical that we, all of the people who are, whether you're in Pulp Revolution or whether you're in Superverse of SF or, whatever, that you take on board any criticism and absolutely do not, lash out at other people or get really, defensive, because you have to learn and grow and improve. And especially, if you're in the comic business and you get hired at Marvel, the virtue there is not that you're hired at Marvel and you get a big exposure. The virtue there is you have a lot of older people who have been in the industry for a long time and can kind of tell you how this industry works. They can kind of tell you what works or not as far as writing a script, how you properly format a script, what you put in a script. They can tell you, okay, you're going to want to do this with a specific panel or that with a specific panel. They're going to tell you what not to do, and they're going to tell you what to do. And you can push those boundaries and experiment with the form, and a lot of people have. But the benefit of working at Marvel or DC is that you have decades of institutional memory that will tell you how to get your start, get you on the ground level in comics. And if you haven't gone through that sort of internship, then there's a whole lot of stuff that you just don't know.
Right. I mean, they even published a book about it. It's How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way.
Right. You know? So if you don't know that stuff, the only way you're going to learn it is by either reading books like that or, you know, making a bunch of crappy stuff before you get to the good stuff, and just being humble about what you've made, being willing to say, oh, okay, yeah, that really is, you know, kind of a problem. I can see that, and we're going to try and fix that in the future. There were a few basic problems with the book. The first one was, I think that choosing a radically different art style is fine, so long as the art style works with the book, with the material that you're doing. Like Frank Miller, if you compare The Dark Knight Returns and Batman Year One, all right, both by Frank Miller, both kind of, you know, big works, you can see they both have radically different art styles, but the art style that he chose for those two books was apt, was fit for what the feeling, the ambiance, the, you know, themes and whatnot that he was working with. So in Dark Knight Returns, you've got a lot of kind of ugly things, a lot of little circles in between the art, a lot of really rough stuff. And then you have that rigid nine squares, nine panels per page that he plays with now and then, but everything is really in the same 3x3 grid. And it looks grim, it looks gritty, it looks messy, it looks kind of a little bit ugly. Then you turn around and you look at the Batman Year One, and it looks like, and the entire book is kind of situated around a crime movie from the 1970s. That's the sort of feeling that he's going for. Sort of your those crime movies where people are out for revenge and there's, you know, drug dealers and heroin dealers and all that other stuff, sort of the 1970s noir thing, Death Wish, the Death Wish movies, or the Dirty Harry movies, because that's the feel he's going for. So he chose a radically different art style than you normally get in comics just to underscore what he was trying to do with the comic. So my main complaint with Quantum Mortis is not that they have a radically different and unusual art style. It's that the art style doesn't seem chosen deliberately to mesh with the material that they're presenting. It doesn't seem to match the Quantum Mortis book itself. And there's a disconnect between this radically different art style than you would get in normal comics, even normal non-superhero comics, and the material they've chosen. And I think that's something that needed to be addressed before it went to press.
Yeah, you're probably right about that. I mean, you know, just like looking at the different approaches to comics, like I'm more familiar with Alan Moore's work than Frank Miller. I've read some of the Sin City comic books, but, you know, I'm more familiar with Alan Moore. So like if you look at a comic like Watchmen, the art is very kind of, you know, gritty, and it still fills out that superhero thing where there's a lot of color, and, you know, the characters themselves are very bright, even if they're dark people like the comedian. And then you look at something like V for Vendetta. Everything is very dark, very understated. It's gritty. It looks almost grimy. Whereas, you know, Watchmen looks very clean, unless, you know, there's certain parts where you're dealing with a character like Rorschach, where everything is supposed to look dark and gritty and grimy, because that's the kind of character that he is. But, you know, it's, like you said, it's all about fitting the art style to the type of story that you're trying to tell. So even within Watchmen, Alan Moore and the people who worked with him on that comic book kind of varied up the art style for the different character stories that they were telling over the course of the comic.
And in Watchmen, one of the things you'll notice is that all of the bright colors they put in there are secondary colors. They're purple, orange, green. They're secondary colors. Whereas in a typical comic book, you have a lot of strong primary colors, red, yellow, blue. And so even within the colorization of the comic, even though it's vividly colored, it's deliberately chosen. The color palette is deliberately chosen to be just a bit off, or sometimes strikingly off, depending on how much you notice things, choices like that, than the regular comic, because they want to do something different. This is a different kind of superhero story, and so they want to set it apart. So instead of primary colors, you get secondary colors on all of the, you know, various things. And that's a deliberate choice they made with the art to differentiate it from normal superhero comics.
Yeah, especially the stuff that DC was publishing at the time, because I believe that DC... Was it DC or was it Vertigo that put out... No, Vertigo was... Vertigo was V for Vendetta. I think that DC published Watchmen.
Yeah, I don't think Vertigo existed yet when Watchmen started being published. They hadn't created that imprint for their, like, mature stuff yet. I saw a lot of people getting very upset and very defensive over a book that really did have some, you know, pretty strong flaws and really did need to get those addressed. And I just thought that people needed to kind of ramp down the combativeness, because if you haven't gone through a long internship, then you're going to be learning from scratch. You're going to be making a lot of elementary mistakes that other people aren't making, and you need to be humble and learn from it. When a comics pro comes in and says, you know, this is a mistake you make, you can't dismiss him or dismiss his knowledge of the industry or dismiss what he's telling you about what works in this medium. I mean, comics is a visual medium, and like every other medium, you do things differently in comics than you do in prose, than you do in movies. And when you come into movies, as an example, there's a whole different language you have to learn about how to set up a film in such a way that it's intelligible, that people can read it and understand your story. Because it's really easy to make a story that's so confusing that your audience won't understand what's going on. And so you go to a film class, or you study it on set and talking with the director, or you learn it yourself by making all these mistakes. But in any case, before you can be a great director, you need to learn the language of film, and that's important, and it matters for film. And the same thing applies to comics. You need to learn how comics are different than writing a novel and do that differently.
Yeah, because I remember back when he was just working on or starting to work on the alt hero thing, he would do his dark streams just about every night, and I would usually tune in. And he was talking about how well it was going and everything, but he was having he didn't say that he was having trouble with the script. He was saying, you know, I would write out a certain amount of words, and I would think, okay, this is probably like, I don't know, 6 pages of a comic book. And then I would pass it off to the artist, and they would be like, this is going to be like 20 pages. So I think that that's one of the things, because Vox is a very well-spoken guy, and he's very intelligent. So he can be pretty verbose when he wants to be, or when he's trying to get his point across very, very finely. So maybe it would be a good idea to listen to somebody like Ethan, who understands how to write comic books, to try to shorten things up, because that's one of the complaints that I keep noticing when I watch someone like Diversity in Comics. Whenever he goes over some of these just god-awful SJW comics, it's always there's too much text on the page. You know, there's stuff that they could have gotten through or just nixed entirely, or you know, said with fewer words. And it's just taking up all of this time, and you only have, like, I don't know what, 21 pages in the book. So, I can understand being defensive about your work, but at the same time, especially if it's like, an industry pro. When an industry pro comes to you and's like, look, here's what you're doing wrong, here's how you can fix it, that's not exactly the kind of guy that you want to just start a fight with.
And the easy assumption of bad faith on his part, like everybody would just jump to the assumption that he has, that all of his criticisms of the work were motivated by he had bad motivations, that he was doing so insincerely. I thought that was a big mistake. And I'm not saying Vox did that. I'm talking not just Vox Day's response, but also the response of a lot of people who are kind of peripherally associated with Vox. A lot of them just seem to assume that he was acting in bad faith, and therefore everything he said was meaningless because it was bad. It was motivated by, hostile.
I can understand how they would get like a hostile vibe from Ethan, because he's talked some shit about Alt Hero. So has DNC, for that matter. They both think it's going to be horrible. Or at least that's what I've gotten from their Twitter feeds. They're like, Ethan says, you know, I'm going to buy a copy when it comes out, and we're going to see what's up. But just looking at it on the face of it, I don't think that it's going to be a very good comic book, because it's, you know, it's not what we're trying to do with the whole comics revolution thing that's going on right now, where they're trying to get the politics out of comics, whether you're right wing or left wing. You know, we don't need caricatures of Alex Jones and I don't know, Paul Joseph Watson and Stefan Molyneux, or, you know, insert right wing pundit here. Just like we don't need caricatures of Stephen Colbert and John Oliver and Jimmy Kimmel and, you know, stuff like that in the comic book just to, you know, look ridiculous or straw man the other side. Which I haven't seen much of that happen with Vox's Alt Hero comic. It just seems like it might be a little bit too on the nose. I think that's what's throwing most people off. Like, I think it has potential to be a seriously good comic book, but it just looks a little bit too on the nose with, like, Captain Europa, or whatever, Captain EU, basically the guy with the EU symbol on his costume. Maybe that's a problem that people are having with it, that it just, like, the way that it looks is going to throw people off, because it looks like political commentary and, at some level, political satire.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Vox is touting it as this thing that's going to come along and save comic books, and Arkhaven Press, I think is the name of his comics line, is going to come along and save comic books and everything, and it's just like, well, you know, there are conservative comic book pros out there that you could take some notes from if they're willing to help you out, and Ethan seems willing to help him out, so.
I had the same reservations about Art Hero, and it wasn't a Kickstarter. What was the site? Whatever the site was.
Freestarter, I think.
Freestarter. Yeah, I contributed to the Freestarter because I wanted to read the comic, and I wanted, when the Chuck Dixon comic was announced, I wanted to check that out too. So I contributed enough to the Freestarter to get those books, but my main worry about it was that it would in fact be politically oriented kind of parody, or satire, or just a commentary on it, which, and I'm not worried about saving comics. That isn't my, I'm not trying to save comics. Other people are, who are more better placed than I am to do that, and that's fine. That's they're better placed to do that than I am anyway. But, so I wasn't worried about whether or not his comic would save comics. I was just worried about being political, because I generally find that boring. And even authors I really like who have messages in their material that I actually agree with, I tend to find that kind of, if it's obvious and loud, I find that boring. And that's the last thing I want in a work of fiction, is anybody doing a message piece.
Yeah, and God forbid that I criticize The Mountain That Writes, but I've just started listening to the first Monster Hunter International book, And it's a great book. I absolutely love it. But there's certain parts in this book where, like, it's totally obvious that Correa is a gun nut. Like, absolutely crazy about firearms. And I like guns, too, you know, don't get me wrong. I like that kind of stuff. But at the same time, every time this dude comes into contact with a gun or he's describing their loadout or anything like that, he gets into just unnecessarily deep detail about the kind of firearms that they have and what company they came from and the modifications that are on them and stuff like that. And, you know, some of that stuff is interesting, like the scene where he gets the giant mutant shotgun that the guy puts together. Because it's, you know, it's a weird gun. It's a custom job. So, you know, we'd kind of like to know what all this thing can do before he just gets into a fight with it. And it's like, oh, wait a minute. You didn't mention that it had, like, a collapsible bayonet, you know, or something like that. But when you're just talking about, like, the machine guns that they're using or the submachine guns, you can mention, like, the name and, you know, the model. But you don't have to get into, like, details about the production. And it happens so often that it kind of distracts from the overall tone of the book, you know. So even when someone I like is talking about something that I like a little bit too much in the book, it can distract from the quality of the fiction itself.
I can see where that would be distracting for you. I think that, and I'm going to go back to something Larry has said about it. When he started to write that book, he knew who his audience was. He knew and identified who he wanted to sell his book to. And the people he wanted to sell his book to were primarily gun nuts from the specific forum that he had spent a lot of time from. And the original discussion that had inspired him to create Monster Hunter International. And so he did something I think was smart in the sense that he said, okay, I'm going to write this book about hunting monsters, and it's going to be aimed primarily at gun nuts. And so he put all that, and they call it gun porn. That's what people call it. He put all that in there because his audience was gun nut guys who would know what all of that means. And so when you said, oh, it's an EOD site, they would instantly know what that means and be able to compare it to other sites without having to spend a lot of time explaining it in the book. And to kind of take this back to Quantum Mortis, I don't get a sense reading Quantum Mortis that there was a sharply defined audience for the book. I don't know who the book is intended for.
From Ethan's review, it kind of seems like, and once again, I haven't read the comic, I'm just going with what I saw that Ethan was able to show in the video without getting like a copyright strike. Not that I think Vox would do something like that, but, you know, just in general. It seems like it's more for like the hardcore futuristic science fiction, like the Blade Runner type people, like the people that are really into movies like Blade Runner, or, you know, other Philip K. Dick movies like Minority Report or something like that. That kind of seems like who it was aimed at. But once again, like, you know, gun nuts and science fiction fans or fantasy fans or urban fantasy fans, you're already looking at kind of a small market there. And this, it's the same thing with Blade Runner. Like, Blade Runner is one of the most respected movies of all time, but it's, you know, every time I see it described, they're calling it a cult hit. And I'm like, how is this movie a cult hit? This is Ridley Scott doing, you know, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? How is this cult? But apparently I'm looking at this from a very small perspective. So I'm just kind of like, everybody I know has seen this movie. So how is this a cult movie? Everyone's fucking seen Blade Runner. But apparently that audience is smaller than I thought it was. So maybe he wasn't clear in who he was targeting, but it kind of seems like that's the audience that he was shooting for when he was making it. And I'm not a mind reader. I don't know what Vox was shooting for. Maybe he just wanted to write the story. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not saying that it's going to be a disaster, and I'm not saying that Alt Hero is going to be a disaster, or that the P.G. Wodehouse book that was just released in the last couple of days. I'm not saying those are going to be disasters, but at the same time, they Quantum Mortis had a lot of weaknesses that ought to be addressed going forward, because if they're not fixed, then it is not going to be I don't think it's going to be very successful outside of the Castalia House crowd. And there's I talked about this on a mailing list I'm on with the Superverse of SF, and Brian Niemeyer picked it up for his site. I took screenshots and stuff describing this. There is a distinct, on Amazon, there is a distinct Castalia House ghetto.
Yeah, I've noticed that too.
Where, you know, if you look at any one Castalia House book, what it recommends that people buy are other Castalia House books, and it, for the most part, and all of the customers who bought this also bought thing. And if you look at all, pretty much all the Castalia House books, and even books of people who aren't from Castalia House but are closely related to it, like the Superverse of SF people, it's a strong benefit for Castalia House that they have an audience who's willing to buy everything the company makes. But it is also a weakness, because that means their books aren't being marketed to people outside of that group. They're not being marketed to normies. And that's a very bad thing, because it means that you are limiting the reach of your marketing efforts, your free marketing efforts that Amazon is doing on your behalf. You're limiting its reach because you're not being sold to other people whose audience might like your work. You're not reaching as big an audience as you could be because you're in this kind of ghetto. And it is, I'm happy that Quantum Mortis and Right Ho Jeeves both became number one on Amazon, but at the same time, that doesn't mean what it would normally mean for, let's say, you know, Christopher Nuttall or Larry Correa. For them to get number one, that means that their book is also being marketed to a wide range of on other books' pages, where if people go to buy something else, they'll see, oh, people who bought this book also bought Larry Correa's Monster Hunter International.
Yeah, like if somebody was going to buy a Jim Butcher Harry Dresden novel.
Yeah.
You know, the people who bought this book also bought Monster Hunter International. And, you know, I mean, it looks like a really cool cover, and then you go and read the blurb about it, and it sounds really cool. And, you know, this is like, you know, in the same vein as the Harry Dresden novels. So, you know, people who like Jim Butcher's work would probably like Larry Correa's work too. So it's all about, like, not necessarily leeching off of bigger authors, but finding people who write in the same vein that you do, and then, like, kind of just tapping that.
Right. And by the way, I after noticing this on my own, I also got in contact with Jason Ansbach and Nick Cole, who have an entire podcast series about this, talking about how they marketed Galaxy's Edge to specifically get away from ghettos like this. And I'm going to have them on the Geek Gab podcast in a week and a half to talk about this. So I'll go into more detail. Those of you who don't understand what I'm saying or don't believe me when I tell you this, I'll go into more detail on Geek Gab, and you can come in and hear about it. But there is a group of books that are only being marketed to people who've also bought other Castalia House books. So it's very incestuous sales. And as far as anybody else outside of that knows, they don't ever see them. If they haven't heard about them on the web or from Vox's website or from, you know, authors who are kind of involved in this ghetto, they're not going to hear about those books, and they're not, so they're not even going to buy them. If you've never heard about a book, you're not going to buy it. And so the fact that Right Ho Jeeves and Quantum Mortis both hit number one, that's great. That is absolutely success. That is money in the bank for Arkham, and it's money in the bank for Castalia House. But it's reaching the same limited audience that the Castalia House of the Castalia House ghetto. And that can be enough to sustain a business, but also might not be. Superversive Press launched a pulp magazine that went six issues before it folded. And the problem was, is they were only reaching people in the ghetto. It was firmly in the Castalia House ghetto, and it didn't appeal to the people who, because it wasn't from Castalia House. It didn't appeal to those people. They didn't buy it for the same reasons they buy, like, for example, Rocky Mountain Retribution. And so it did not succeed because it wasn't being sold to a broad audience, and so it shut down. And, you know, I'm a friend with the person who runs Superversive Press, and I was very sad when that happened. But at the same time, you have to – this is something you should be aware of if you're going to be selling on Amazon, and it's something you need to avoid, is having your book fall into this ghetto. And it is not necessarily a good sign. It can give people involved with Arkham a false sense of confidence that their book is going to be or is reaching a larger audience than it actually is reaching.
Right, and it doesn't seem like a very sustainable model to me either. Because, you know, let's just say you're pulling a number out of the ether here, there's 20,000 people that are really big fans of Castalia House. Like you say, they'll buy whatever the company puts out. Once those 20,000 people, so far as I know, if you drop a book and on day one, like 15,000 people go and buy it, that's probably enough to put you in number one in your little subcategory. Which is certainly something to be proud of. I mean, 15,000 people just bought your thing, but, you know, once they have it, they already have it. They're not going to be buying it again. And then if they don't get out there and tell their normie friends about it, who don't know what, have never fucking heard of Castalia House before, then you're not going to see a lot of continuing sales. There's not going to be a high, they call it retention rate on YouTube when people like watch your videos and then come back for more. But there's not going to be a big retention of the audience because the audience already has their copy of the thing. And if you're not putting out comics monthly or even weekly like a place like Marvel or DC does, then you kind of need to rely on that word of mouth to see the sales continue. Not necessarily as successful as day one, but at least selling, you know, I don't know, 1,000 copies a month or something like that.
So I just... I think that people who were peripherally involved, fans of it, were too defensive, and that it seemed like there were valid criticisms that were being ignored out of this defensiveness. And you just...
Basically, people just need to calm down.
Yeah.
Like, just because somebody criticizes something that Vox Day does doesn't mean that they're attacking Vox Day. And it's easy to understand why they would think that, because Vox Day does get attacked a lot. And a lot of the times, it's unjust. But when someone's, like, offering legit criticism, you know, you need to be able to separate an attack from somebody who's trying to tear him down from somebody who's actively trying to help him do better.
Yeah.
And who's not attacking, but just offering constructive criticism.
And you know what? Even if they are being harsh, if what they're saying is correct, you have to be open to the idea that what they're saying is correct and just roll with it. Learn about it, understand it, do something, listen to it and analyze it and say, well, is this correct? I just
yeah, like, I don't know, like, for example, this BS that I got into this week with this Laird Barron guy. Apparently he's big in like the horror scene and things like that. I've never heard of the guy before this week, but you know, in the post that I responded to his little, you know, his little Facebook blurb about, I said, you know, I've got stuff out. I've got an anthology with my work out there. I'm publishing stuff on Steemit. I'm easy to find. You can go and read it for free. And I've got a story coming out in Kirsova magazine that you can read for essentially 50 cents is what that issue of the magazine would be worth if you pick up the ebook copy. It's a dollar to get the spring and summer issues in ebook form. So I said, you know what, if you think I'm gonna show you my ass fiction wise, then go and buy my stuff, go and read the free stuff that I have out, and let me know what you think. You know, and if he comes to me and it's just nothing but, you know, derogatory BS that doesn't concentrate on story structure or, you know, writing style or characterization or dialogue or, you know, even, you know, fiddly shit like grammar and punctuation, then I'm going to be able to disregard it as an attack because he's not actually giving me anything to go off of to get better. But if he goes and reads it and he's like, okay, well, here's what I think you're doing wrong. And then he has this list like Kahutek did. Kahutek is a guy on, Steemit with the rest of us. He's one of the Pulp Rev guys on Steemit. And, he reviewed one of my stories and he was like, look, I like the story, but you don't have it yet. You know, you have potential to get it, but there's a lot of shit in the story that's wrong that you need to go fix. So, you know, I read his whole review and I was like, okay, you know what? Shit, you're right. You know, that's the way, these are problems and I need to fix it. So I'm going to endeavor to do better on the feud. Unfortunately, I can't go back and fix that story because it's already logged on the blockchain and you can't really go and change the blockchain. But in the future, I can and take these criticisms into account and learn how to write better. And if Laird Barron came to me and did the same thing that Kahutek did, you know, I would listen to him because the guy's been out here for longer than I have. He's a professional. He's traditionally published. So, you know, that's a strike against him. But, you know, if he's got valid criticisms, then I'll listen to him.
You know, yeah, that guy. That was a really, really strange post that dude did. I don't even. This is a really strange question to talk about that with, but what the hell does they're about to show me their ass? What does that even mean?
The way that I interpreted it was, you know, because I had said, you know, I had talked shit about the Old Venus anthology, right? Which every review that I'd read, like, I was excited about Old Venus when I first heard of it. I was like, oh, this looks cool as hell. This is like, you know, we're getting back to like 60s sci-fi movies where people would go to Venus and run into all of these crazy aliens and shit. And every review that I read about it was just like, you know, this is just message fiction. It's boring. The stories go nowhere. They do nothing. There's barely any action. And I'm sitting here like, well, what, how do you take a concept this cool and fuck it up that badly? So what I did was I wrote a story that, you know, okay, this guy is in a spaceship, he crash lands on Venus, and there's like, it's like the Savage Land. There's dinosaur kind of creatures running around all over the place, there's lizard men, there's tribes of human-like creatures. It's kind of, you know, a mash together of like a John Carter type story and the Old Venus stuff. So I put significantly more action in that story than it probably needed, but you know, whatever, I like watching stuff go boom. And I think that what he meant by show your ass is that, like, if he goes and reads the Old Venus anthology and then he goes and reads my story, if my story is not significantly better than the stuff that's in the Old Venus anthology, then I have embarrassed myself, essentially, is what I think he meant. Like I said, I can't read the guy's mind, but
yeah, I've never heard of that. I've never heard that phrase before. Here's the thing. I don't know who this guy is. I've never read any of his stuff and I don't really care, but his rant was, it was so boring and played out. And basically he was standing up and down and screaming at the top of his lungs saying, you know, SJW books are too relevant and they're the wave of the future. That's the meaning behind what he was saying. That's what he was trying to get across, was we're right and we're great and no one's going to come into science fiction and fantasy and tell us we're doing anything wrong, because all those old heroes suck. They were awful, and SJW heroes are awesome, and that's where it's at. And it's like, dude, you're lost, man. Put down the crack pipe.
Yeah, like you don't have to stop smoking. Just let the pipe grow cold every now and again. Yeah, because I have the thing up right here, and he's talking about like Beowulf and Conan and Fafhrd and the Mouser, and Tarzan, John Wayne, Achilles, Hercules, and he even does the quote-unquote heroes thing. They were all bloodthirsty pricks. Entertaining, yes. Problematic, if not downright pricks, yeah. And the thing that blows my mind is that he says we don't need new Vances, Howards, or Tolkiens telling those same old stories updated for the present day. Like, these are some of the greatest writers in the English language. These are the people who literally created the genres that all of the rest of us are writing in right now. And to say that going back to that well and, you know, getting the same water that they had and putting it in a new vessel is a bad idea just seems insane to me. Like, what if these stories are so enduring? Like I said, I've never even heard of Laird Barron before. And he's been writing since like the mid-90s. And, or at least I think, that's what I gathered from his Wikipedia page. But I've never even heard of this guy before. I had no idea who Robert E. Howard was when I was 15. But I damn sure knew who Conan was.
Yep.
You know, I damn sure knew who Tarzan was. You know, I knew who Beowulf was because they made us read part of that legend in high school English. The idea that you can look at stories like that that have endured this long and say there's nothing there that we can learn from is just mind blowing to me.
If these people were producing works as good as, you know, Howard or Tolkien or whomever, it would be a completely different matter than what they're doing right now. They are absolutely not. They're producing garbage, and the audience is running away from it because of garbage. So,
like you were talking about ghettos earlier. And that's effectively what they're doing here with this stuff that they're putting out nowadays, is that they're creating this ghetto where they are the elite in this ghetto. And it's like, okay, well, you can have your little block party in this ghetto and act like you're, you know, the president of the United States of America or the Queen of England or whatever. But, you know, at the end of the day, you're in a square city block. And nobody outside of that city block is paying attention to you other than to call the cops on you when you get a little bit too rowdy. So, like, if you're not trying to actively reach, like, with the people in the comics industry that keep coming out and saying, you know, don't read my stuff if you don't like the social justice messaging. It's like, well, okay, fine, we won't read it, but you've got to understand that your market share is going to shrink because you're actively driving away loyal customers.
Diversity and Comics just did a show yesterday about the December numbers for comic shops, and it is
absolutely
disastrous. And it is exactly because of how these people act on social media, but also what they put in their comics. They're making crap. They're making crap and people hate it. And they can fake all the numbers they want, but at the end of the day, social justice people, they don't buy comics. They don't buy,
they'll get on the bandwagon for one or two issues. Like when, I remember, back when Gamergate was going on and they had Femme Thor come out, where they made, what's her name, Jane Foster Thor. The first issue of that comic sold, I want to say it sold almost as well as any, it was in like the top 10 best-selling Thor comics ever since the start of the character. And then, like, the second one, there was like a 64% drop-off in sales. It was ridiculous, because the people that came out and they were all rah-rah girl power, oh, we got a male superhero turned into a woman, they bought the first issue, but then when the second issue came out next month, they didn't go back to the comic shop and pick that one up. You know, I doubt they even read the first one. And the people who did buy it because they were interested in the character or what they were doing in this experiment that they were putting on, they read that one and it was crap. The art was crap, the story was crap, the writing was crap. And they just, well, okay, I'm just not going to buy this anymore.
Yep. It's, I have a lot of thoughts on that and a lot of rants on that, but it's very, very hard to build up an audience and very, very easy to drive them away and very, very easy to put things such that, to create work that will drive an audience away that is, it's hard to get back from there. It's hard because you basically have to, you have to not only just start over again, but if you reached a bunch of the people who are interested, I mean, let's take comics, for example. Comics are only going to appeal to a certain percentage of the population. They're not going to appeal to everybody. Not everybody likes comics. And so, if you, let's say there's an audience of a million people in the country who will like comics, who will occasionally buy comics, and you are having regularly about half of them buying comics, let's just say, it's nowhere near that right now, but let's say that during the 80s or 90s, that was the case. I'm just making these numbers up.
I mean, you're not that far off, because I remember looking up numbers from like 94 and stuff like that. And there were comics back then that sold like 300 million copies, or 300,000, I'm sorry, like 300,000 copies.
Right, because no one title's going to appeal to everybody who's potentially buying them on the regular.
Yeah.
So you go out and you do a bunch of stuff that pisses off these people or bores them, and they just stop buying comics. The problem you have is now you have, and let's say you've driven off 250,000 of the people who may have bought your comic at its peak. The problem is, it's not like you're an indie title or like your Image at the very beginning, who nobody knew anything about, who only knew about their artists because they had been big in Marvel, Todd McFarlane and all the rest of them, and who started off selling books and people started picking them up. So you're selling to people who are new. You're selling to people who don't know anything about your title and are at least willing to give it a try. And it's for most people, that's a steady but kind of lengthy process. But for Marvel now, they've pissed off so much of their audience base that they don't even get to sell to people who've never heard of them. They don't get to sell to people who don't know how bad Marvel is. They're having to try and reach out to people who said, screw you and all of your titles, I'm done, I'm not buying anymore, or who just wandered away because they got bored. They're having to reactivate customers who have had a bad experience with their product, and that's always tougher than finding people brand new. That's one of the things I learned when I was working in retail, when I was working in fast food, is that it's always easier to keep an existing customer than to try to get them back. Because if you've lost them as a customer, it means you've done something wrong and they're going to be upset. And trying to get them back is always tougher than reaching new customers. And that is tougher than keeping the ones you already have.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the things that mystifies me, to kind of wrap this back to the whole fiction thing, is that stories like The Lord of the Rings or Planet of Adventure or Conan or Tarzan or John Carter of Mars or Pellucidar or things like that, they're geared towards young boys, essentially. Anybody can read these stories and enjoy them, but your primary audience that would just absolutely devour that, that kind of writing is young boys between the ages of like, I don't know, like, maybe 8 and 16. So if you're not appealing to that demographic specifically, you can also try to appeal to girls and everything like that, but it's been shown time and again that industries that are primarily organized around geek stuff, like sci-fi, fantasy, comic books, tabletop RPGs, card games and things like that, the primary audience, we're talking like anywhere from 60 to 80% of the audience, is male. So if you're not appealing to the guys, then you're cutting out a big share of the market. And what's more, if you hook them when they're young, if you get, like, if you give a young boy a Tarzan book, it, like, they just hit puberty or whatever, they're around 13, you hand them Tarzan or Conan, they're going to read that, and they're going to be, if they enjoy it, they're going to be hooked for life. That's going to be their thing. It happened to me, that's exactly the way that I went about this. I got a hold of some good sword and sorcery, I saw some good movies that were in that vein back when I was a kid, and I was just hooked for life on fantasy and sci-fi. So if you get these kids when they're young, then they're going to be repeat customers, and you know, they'll even put up with dips in quality between different books, so long as you, you know, don't stay in the bad area. But when these people get to like where I am now, like I'm almost 30 and I've been reading comic books my entire life, and I've been reading sci-fi and fantasy and horror my entire life. And you get to the point where you have pissed me off so badly that I will never buy another product of yours. And I'm actively encouraging my friends and family and even enemies to just don't buy these people anymore. You know, you're getting that part, not just my sale. You've not only lost my sale, you've lost all of the sales of the people that I talk to about this. So just kind of shrinking, you're actively and purposefully shrinking your own ghetto.
And you're making anti-customers.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
You're not just, there's not a bunch of neutral people out there. It's anti-customers, people who deliberately don't want to check out your stuff and won't in the future. Star Wars has turned me into an anti-customer.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
With this last movie. If you can't trust the people you're buying from, most people aren't going to even try out new stuff. The new stuff might be great, but they're not going to be willing to try it out because you've pissed on them for so long.
Exactly. Like, I don't envy C.B. Cebulski his job right now. He's got a lot of correcting the course of that ship to do, and I personally don't think he's going to be able to do it. And I'm one of those people that has been shat on so much because I pay attention to this kind of stuff, that, you know, it's over for me. Marvel's done. I don't care if Marvel goes bankrupt and Disney folds the company anymore. I really don't. It would be horrible if Marvel disappeared because they're an American institution. You know, they're basically the backbone of good cape comic books. But they have pissed me off so badly over the past 5 years or so that I just don't care if they go bankrupt anymore, and I'm not coming back. You know, even if CB manages to fire all of the SJWs, turn the ship around, hire great artists, great writers, they start putting love and care and affection back into these characters and these stories, and they start respecting the fans more, I'm still not coming back. I'm, like you said, I'm an anti-customer at this point.
It's a grave error for people to have, for them to have gone in this direction. And, you know, like you said, it comes from the SJWs because they don't care. They have absolute contempt for the audience. And it doesn't matter to them whether Marvel succeeds or fails or whether particular characters are beloved or loathed. It just doesn't matter to them. They do not give a crap.
I have a theory about this. I think that because the roots of the social justice ideology are in communism, which is necessitated by an overbearing state that actively funds propaganda art, essentially. Like, that's what the USSR did. Because that's the basis of their ideology, they have this mentality that they shouldn't have to respect the capitalist system that they're currently operating in, and people should be forced to buy or read their stuff, and it should all be based off, like, government grants or anything like that. And I get the feeling that if they think that if they keep going, eventually the government is just going to come along and say, here's a grant, it doesn't matter if people are buying your stuff anymore, and the company should have folded a long time ago. Here's your like the way that Google is doing with YouTube. YouTube hasn't turned a profit in God only knows how long. But Google keeps funneling money into it because it's worth it to them to be able to control narratives. So I think that that's where this contempt for the customer comes from, is that that communist base of their entire thought process and approach to life. Like Aubrey Sitterson, he thinks that he can come in as an avowed socialist who hates the military and the cops and write G.I. Joe, an American Hero, and turn it into this crazy grab bag of social justice bullshit, and that people are just going to suck it up and buy the comic books because, what, they don't have any other choice? Like, there aren't other military comic books out there that they could read?
Yeah.
You know, it's they just have a fundamental misunderstanding of the market that they're operating in, or the system that they're operating in, and they refuse to adapt to it because they think that they're better than it.
They definitely think they're better than their audience. They definitely think that they are... They think they're just, you know, the bee's knees. And they have done incalculable damage to Marvel Comics. They've done incalculable damage to science fiction. And they're doing incalculable damage to Star Trek and Star Wars, and
they're even doing it with Dynamite and the old pulp characters that they have, like the Shadow and Doc Savage and Green Hornet and people like that. I think they even have Conan and Tarzan. You know, they're doing incalculable. Like I just recently rewatched Razor Fist's review of the new Social Justice Shadow comic, and I was just like, you know what? He's right. Why the fuck am I still following Dynamite on Twitter? Why am I even thinking about buying anything that they have ever made again, given what they just did to the Shadow?
Or what they did to the John Carter.
Deja Thoris. Oh, God. Yeah, that was the last straw right there. That was... that pissed me off. That really pissed me off.
You look at these people and they've just dug a hole that all the good intentioned people, I don't see how they're really going to, you know, really going to, because it's not like comics fans have just been sitting around being bored and staring at the walls once they stopped being able to read comics. They didn't just, you know, wander away. They've gone out and found other things to hold their interest. And now you have to win them back from those other things. And that's just, that is very, very difficult to do.
To say the least. And it's the same thing with sci-fi and fantasy. Like, the sales have been dropping ever since this, like, shit was booming back in the pulp era. It was a huge industry. Everybody read this stuff. There were a million magazines out there doing detective stories and fighter pilot stories and science fiction stories and horror stories and weird fiction and sword and sorcery and sword and planet. There were entire magazines that were devoted to these individual concepts alone. And everybody read this stuff. And then these people came in and they started trying to treat it like it was serious literature. Like, they're fucking, like, Charles Dickens or some shit. And the audience has been gradually drifting away ever since. And just because some people are able to make livings off of this stuff now doesn't mean that the audience hasn't shrunk. Like, 100 years ago, somebody like Nick Cole would never have to worry about any kind of financial thing ever again. He would be, especially with his level of productivity, you know, he would never have to worry about anything ever again because he would be making so much money off of his writing because everybody would be reading it. He would be right next to Robert E. Howard and H.P. Lovecraft. And nowadays, he's famous, yes, and a lot of people read his books and a lot of people know who he is and, you know, he's broken out of the ghetto, like you say, but that audience that was there back in the 30s has not gone away. You know, I mean, of course, people have died and stuff like that, but there's still about that many people that are interested in these kind of stories. But the stories themselves, the stories that they go and pick up at the store, just aren't fun. They're not... Yeah. There's no sense of wonder to them. There's no sense of mystery, of horror, of otherworldliness to them anymore. It's just boring message fiction. It's just a vehicle for these people to push their politics. It's propaganda. And people don't want to read propaganda. That's why Jack Chick, the guy who wrote Chick Tracks, is a joke, because he was a fundamentalist Christian propagandist. And he could have been doing like a Sunday paper news strip, you know, comic strip, for decades and decades and decades if he had just stopped preaching at people. But, you know, it's the exact same thing with these people. They don't want to stop preaching, therefore the audience will continue to shrink, which is, you know, what we're trying to reverse right here, and we've got a hell of a road ahead of us because there's so much competition from things like, well, maybe not movies so much anymore, but... you know, video games and stuff like that, there's so much competition out there for us to try to win that reading audience back, and we have to adapt our approach to it. We can't be releasing these, you know, 400-page fantasy novels anymore, you know, that go on for like 18 books that the author's going to die before he finishes. Cough, George R.R. Martin, cough. We can't have this message fic running the roost at, like, Clark's World. Clark's World is supposed to be a magazine. They're supposed to live or die by their magazine sales. They have a Patreon. They cannot run their business based on their magazine sales because the stories in the magazine are fucking boring and not a lot of people are reading them. So they had to open up a Patreon so people could give them more money on top of what they're already paying for the magazine. So you've got this steadily shrinking pool of people that you're trying to squeeze more and more money out of to keep your business running. And eventually you're just going to fail. At a certain point within the next few years, I predict Clark's World is going to go under. They're just not going to be able to do it anymore because they refuse to reverse course and start publishing fun science fiction stories anymore. It's got to be message fic. Or if not message fic, it's got to be science. It's got to be lit fic that's pretending to be science fiction.
Yeah, it's. I just want to go and read people who know how to make fun, entertaining, exciting science fiction and fantasy. That's it.
Yeah, same here.
I don't need to or want to read boring, pedantic, preachy, condescending crap.
Especially when all of the people that are surrounding this boring, preachy, condescending crap are so utterly horrible.
Yeah.
Like this Laird Barron guy. I'm never going to read a fucking word of his stories now. You know, there was a point in time where I took that to the guys in Dimension Bucket Media and I was like, have you guys ever heard of this guy before? Cause I haven't, but he's heard of me. and, they were like, oh, yeah, this guy's like a big horror author, and he's kind of big at StokerCon and stuff like that. And I was like, really? This guy? Really? And because of the way he acted, you know, I didn't even attack him first. You know, I didn't even go after him. I went after Martin and Dozois and the general trend in science fiction and fantasy that I've been noticing with the releases of these books, given the reviews by the people that I trust to know what the difference between a good book and a bad book, because they've proven that they are, or that they know the difference. So I didn't even attack this guy. I didn't even mention him at all. It wasn't even in his genre. This was a sword and sorcery anthology. It had nothing to do with the horror scene whatsoever. But he decided to put his fucking foot in his mouth, and now he's lost a customer, or a potential customer. I might have gone and picked up some of the anthologies that he's worked on, because he's got a lot. There's a lot on his Wikipedia page. There's a bunch of stuff there that I might have read and enjoyed had he not shown his ass, to quote him.
It's just, and Diversity in Comics has said this, that there is no industry outside of entertainment where, you know, if you're a clerk working at a store and you treat people who wander into your store like this, you'll get fired so quickly. And yet they can do it just casually and they don't even think about it. It's like they're completely insulated from the consequences of their own decisions. And it's just befuddling to me.
And then it's especially bad when you follow somebody like Peter Cimetti, the guy who runs Alterna Comics, or the Alterna Comics main account itself. When you go and follow these people, the only thing I ever see them do is interact with fans, especially since Diversity in Comics has started pimping them. The only thing that I ever see them do is somebody will post a picture of, like, their kids. I saw this one earlier. Peter Cimetti himself and the Alterna main account responded to this tweet. Someone was like, you know, you got to get them started early. Hashtag, you know, bringing back newsprint. And then they tagged Alterna and Peter in it. And he was just like, oh, my God, this warms my heart so much. Thank you. You know, and the Alterna Comics account retweeted it with a heart emoji. And, you know, that's how they treat all of their fans. Even when the SJW started attacking him and it was like, you know, you're being promoted by a racist and a sexist and don't you care that you have white nationalists reading your comic books? And Peter was like, just like, look, I'm not able to pick who reads my comic books. If they read and enjoy the comic books, then good, fine. I'm glad they enjoyed it. That's what I put them out there for. I'm not able to choose who my audience is, you know? So if they read it and enjoy it, then I'm grateful that they're enjoying my comic books. I'm not trying to be political here. I'm staying out of it. And I was just like, this is the most respectful person I have seen in the entertainment industry in like 3 years. And that kind of attitude really makes me want to go buy more Alterna comics.
Yeah. I really think that humility and, a due regard for who is paying your paychecks, who is paying your rent. I really think that's something that a lot of people involved in these industries could really stand to learn. It's like, oh, yeah, you know what? These people, they don't have to pay attention to me. They can pay attention to a billion other things out there that are much, you know, and so I should be, if they're willing to come in and buy my stuff, I should treat them like gold.
Yeah, it's absolutely baffling to me that these people will be so disrespectful to the people that like what they're doing. Like, even back when I was doing YouTube videos and I didn't even have anything monetized, I was just doing it for shits and giggles to, like, decompress after college classes. You know, whenever somebody would leave a comment on one of my videos, or now that I'm doing it with the stories on Steemit, whenever somebody stops by and actually reads the thing and they leave a comment, I'm just like, hey, thank you. You know, I'm glad that you're enjoying it. Or if they say that there's something that I need to work on, then I say, okay, you have a point. I will, I will work on that in the future. Thank you for bringing that to my attention. You know, I'll do better next time. You know, I'm insanely grateful that people are just enjoying the content that I'm putting out there. You know, I don't care where they come. I don't go and like, oh, this guy left a comment on my YouTube video. I better go and make sure he's not watching Richard Spencer, you know, speeches or whatever. I don't fucking care. Their life is their business. If they came to my video and they liked it and they left a comment, I'm happy that they enjoyed the thing that I put out there, you know? I just don't get this mentality of disrespecting, even if you're not doing it for money, you know, even if you're just doing it for free, doing it for fun, like the people on fanfiction.net that will write 100,000 word fanfics about Supernatural or whatever. They're insanely grateful that people just come by and read it, let alone, oh my God, you left a comment. Thank you. So these professionals, quote unquote, that want to come out here and act like this, is just like, you have been away from like reality for too long. You have been in your ivory tower for way too long. You need to get street level, pull a Daredevil, run around Harlem for a little while, and, you know, get back in touch with the people, because that's who you're ultimately doing this for.
If you don't have an audience, then you don't have a paycheck, and you need to, and you're going to be forced to go do something else.
Exactly.
So, yeah, I just, there are a bunch of other things I guess I could talk about, but,
I mean, I'm good to keep going if you want to bring up something else.
I think that covered most of the stuff I wanted to hit tonight.
Okay. That's fair enough.
I would like to talk to you off the air, though, once we're done.
Yeah, sure. No problem. No problem whatsoever. So you want to go ahead and call it here, so far as the recording goes?
As I would just encourage everyone who is involved in the Pulp Revolution. Oh, by the way, you're talking about Steam It. Ben Chia, who was the guy that kind of pushed Steam It into the, you know, knowledge space around the Pulp Revolution, who got everybody interested in that platform. We're going to have him on Geek Gab this weekend to talk about Steam It. So it's 7 p.m. Eastern at our YouTube page, youtube.com/geekgab. And so if you're interested in Steam It, or you're just wondering what the heck I'm talking about, it's a blockchain-based blogging platform where likes give you currency. You can get paid on Steam It for posting stories and stuff. So if you're interested in that, we're going to have him on the show to talk about it and explain the model behind it and, you know, how to get involved with it, how to succeed at it. So that's going to be on Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern, youtube.com/geekgab. So I'm looking forward to that episode.
I'm looking forward to that, too, because there's a lot about Steam It that I don't particularly understand. He's been very patient trying to explain it to me, but I'm just a little bit thick on things like cryptocurrency and technology and the blockchain and how all of this stuff works. So like, I get the basic concepts, but there's fine details that he understands that I don't. So I'm looking forward to hearing this one.
But yeah, that's basically it. What I was about to say is, if you're involved in the Pulp Revolution, unless you absolutely know that someone is an SJW or they're motivated by bad faith, that what they're criticizing you about is irrelevant, don't just assume that anyone who criticizes a work is automatically an enemy and then go out of your way to make them an enemy. That's foolish. It's short-sighted, and it prevents you from getting one of the most valuable things that you would need is honest feedback on where you can improve. Because this is a customer service business, writing is, especially writing for entertainment, especially if you're not an SJW, so you're not going to have their vast propaganda machine on your agitating on your behalf. So you want to go out, you want to listen to the audience, and even if people are mostly negative, listen to the people who are mostly negative. That doesn't mean you're going to make the changes they want or you're going to decide, oh, they're right. They may be wrong, but you need to at least listen to them and not immediately dismiss what they say, because that is the route to success in the long run lies in learning what you're doing right and learning what you're doing wrong. And so feedback, especially specific detailed feedback, is gold. That is very, very valuable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like this, this Laird Barron guy, if he had actually given me some detailed feedback rather than just, you know, attacking all of these characters that I, and these writers that I really like and attacking me, you know, on the side, then, you know, I might go and buy his book, or I might take him more seriously, at least in his criticism of my opinions. You know, there's a review, like I say, that Kahutek put up of my story, Fire on the Bayou. That's the kind of criticism that I would say to watch for. If somebody's coming with that kind of detailed criticism where they'll pick things out of your story and be like, this is something that I had a problem with, or this is something that I think you can do better. That's the kind of stuff that you want to listen to. But if somebody comes to you and they're just like, oh, this is problematic because reasons, you can probably safely ignore that person.
That's it. That's all I have.
All right. Well, I guess we'll go ahead and cut it here. Thank you for coming on the show, DW. And
hope you all enjoyed it.
Me too. And yeah, you guys should definitely check out Geek Gab this weekend at, you said, 5?
7 p.m. Eastern Time.
7 p.m. Eastern Time on Saturday, I believe, right?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Saturday, 7 p.m. Eastern. They'll have Ben Shea on to talk about Steam It. And I guess I'll try and get this edited and put up before then so that so that people know about it. But it'll be archived on the YouTube channel and you guys can go and watch it. But all right. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening. And we will catch you guys next time. Peace out, everybody.
All right, everybody, that was the podcast. Thanks again to Daddy Warpig for coming on. I think that we had a very, very productive discussion about all of these various things. And if you would like to come on the podcast, then just get in touch. You know, I'm pretty easy to get a hold of. Unfortunately, I seem to have gotten into some trouble because I've been a bad boy on Twitter. So you're not going to be able to get in touch with me through Twitter for about a week. But various other places like Gab, Minds, Discord, or the email on my blog. So if you need to get in touch with me, just pick one of those options. I'll respond. But let's go ahead and do the sponsors, and then I will get out of y'all's hair. How does that sound? So Patreon, to my knowledge, is still down, so don't worry about that one. We have the Cat Kimbridge audiobooks, which is some good superversive military science fiction with a strong female lead. So if you're into that kind of just fun romp type science fiction where the guy's created his own universe and his own aliens and in certain points his own laws of physics, it's really, really well written. I was very impressed when I first read it, and it was so much fun that when I did book 7 and then I did book 8, in between doing book 8 and book 6, I went back and I read the first 5 books in the series, because it was just so much damn fun. It's by Andrew Beery, and I'll recommend just about anything this guy has written based off the strength of the Cat Kimbridge series. He's a damn fine writer, and this is some damn good military science fiction, so if that sounds like it's your bag, then go ahead and pick those up. Next, we have the Dimension Bucket Media books. We have Hell's 5-Minute Tales of Horror, which is pretty much what it says on the tin. It is a collection of microfiction, spooky microfiction by Hell Richards. So if you're looking for some scary tales to keep you entertained while you're on the train riding to work or something like that, then you can just go ahead and give this one a read. Dimension of Cobwebs is an anthology of weird fiction from Grandmasters of the Craft from back in the day when weird fiction was just now getting started. So we have people like Edgar Allan Poe, Bram Stoker, H.P. Lovecraft, Frank Belknap Long, Hans Heinz Ewers, and H.G. Wells in that anthology. So if you want some nicely curated weird fiction, there you go. Darkest of Dreams is an anthology put together by the Dimension Bucket Media crew of some of our stories, old and new. And it is three stories from each of us, so that's three from me, three from Christopher Warren, a.k.a. Dimension Bucket, three from Connor Goff, a.k.a. Nightshade, and three from William Harmer, a.k.a. Gentleman Walrus. It's mostly horror, but sometimes we get into some other stuff like psychological writing or heroic fantasy or things like that. So if you kind of want to get an idea of where we are as writers, you can go and pick this up. Or you can follow us on Steemit. That's steemit.com, where you can find a lot of our stories up for free. You can just read it. You don't even have to have an account. A Man Upstairs is a collection of creepy, dark verse by Christopher Warren, who is neither a poet, nor does he like freeform poetry, so of course he had to write a book of it. And it's turning out to be very good. It's getting very good reviews, and we're happy with that. So if freeform, spooky, sometimes funny poetry sounds like something that you would enjoy, then go pick up A Man Upstairs. Cracked by Connor Goff, that's C-R-A-C-K apostrophe D, is the story of a man who discovers a horrible secret behind reality, and he has to figure out what's going on before reality falls apart around him. And the way Connor writes, you can't really tell if this is just going on in the guy's head, or if this is actually happening and he's just the only one who knows. So go and check out Cracked. Phoenix on the Sword is the first ever published Robert E. Howard Conan story. It's the first Conan story to ever hit the market, the world's introduction to the Sumerian barbarian. Conan is older, he is middle-aged or so, he's king of Aquilonia. He is lamenting his days as king because he wishes he was just on a battlefield swinging a sword into somebody's face rather than having to deal with affairs of state. And there is a plot to depose him and assassinate him and install a puppet government in his stead. And there is a subplot with a Stygian warlock who summons a baboon demon to kill the people who betrayed him. And Conan winds up fighting it, and he goes under a mountain in a dream and gets a magic sword. And it's basically where sword and sorcery literature started. So if you want to get an idea of why I love Robert E. Howard so much, just go and pick this book up. It's not expensive. Next up, we have Aaron Clary. Aaron is a former banker and economist who blogs at captaincapitalism.blogspot.com, and he runs a consulting business at assholeconsulting.com, where he will give you the absolute straight dope, no bullshit. So if you have any questions about life, the universe, and everything except for legal advice — he's not a lawyer, so he can't give you legal advice — just go on over to assholeconsulting.com, and Aaron Clary will fix you up. He has saved thousands of people, literally hundreds of thousands of dollars, by preventing bad life decisions. It is a paid service. You are going to have to pay for it. But I would say that paying $25 for an email consultation on average and $35 for a video consultation on average is a pretty good deal compared to the $100,000 you could be paying for, you know, useless college courses. He also has a podcast and a YouTube channel, so go ahead and check those out. It's the Aaron Clary podcast on SoundCloud and iTunes, and just search Aaron, A-A-R-O-N, Clary, C-L-A-R-E-Y, on YouTube, and you will find his YouTube channel where you can gain the benefit of his wisdom without having to pay him a single fucking dime. And if you're more into the written word, as we say, he has his blog over at captaincapitalism.blogspot.com, as well as several books out, a few of which I've done the audiobooks for. Most recently, there was Poor Richard's Retirement, which is a short treatise. It's only about 146 pages on how it is possible to achieve fiscally feasible retirement in today's economy. So if you've got any questions about retirement, if you're not worried about it, you should be. Then you can just go and pick up Poor Richard's Retirement in audio, Kindle, or paperback. All of his books are in audio, Kindle, or paperback. So you've got a nice spread of options there. I've also done Enjoy the Decline, Accepting and Living with the Death of the United States, which is just what it says. It is about how the country is basically fucked. There's not really any way to fix it. So you need to realize what you can control and what you can't and adjust your personal philosophy so that you are mentally prepared to deal with the stress that all of this stuff is going to bring down on you. You know, realize what you can control, let go of what you can't, and then just live your life for you, because you can't fix everything, and there's no sense in taking the world on your shoulders. So if you want a more detailed explanation of that, pick up his book, Enjoy the Decline, Accepting and Living with the Death of the United States. He also has Reconnaissance Man, which is a book more for the younger set. It's about how not to waste your life on things that you don't want to do, how to figure out what you want to do and where you want to do it before you actually embark on any journeys to go forth and do your thing. Very useful, lots of good information in it, and I hope that you guys will pick that one up as well. He also has Curse of the High IQ. Now, I didn't do the audiobook for this one, but I did read it, and it is a very, very good book where he kind of teases out this hypothesis that he has that high IQs are correlated with things like depression or social awkwardness, or even, I guess to an extent, autism or not being able to understand certain things. And it's a very, very interesting hypothesis, and I would like to see more legitimate study done on it, but, you know, fat chance of that. So all we have right now is his book, Curse of the High IQ. But if you have any of these problems where you're, you know, socially awkward, or you don't get why people do certain things, or the world moves too slow for you, or you're depressed, or, you know, things like that, go ahead and pick this book up. It might give you some peace of mind. Next up, we have John E. Boyle. John is an author who has written an excellent fantasy novel called Queen's Heir. That's H-E-I-R, as in the heir to the queen, not the air that the queen breathes. You can find it on Amazon.com, and it is a fantasy set among the Hittites at the end of the Bronze Age, and it's just about everything you could want in a sword and sorcery novel. It has swords, it has sorcery, it has demons, it has werewolves, it has love and romance, it has travel, it has war, it has, did I mention the werewolves? It has magic. It's got strained family relationships, it's got old mentors and young pups being impudent, it's got ghosts. Just about every chapter of this book reads like an installment in one of the old school pulp serials. If you've ever read like old sword and sorcery serials, every chapter of this book pretty much reads like a gigantic ongoing serial for about 40 chapters. It's about $5 on Amazon. It is well worth your time, and I am currently producing the audiobook for it, which is taking a lot longer than I expected, but he's working on the sequel. He says he's about halfway done with it last time I talked to him, so I've still got some time to get it done before the next book comes out. So look forward to the audiobook coming out hopefully sometime in the next couple of months here. Like I say, it's immense. You guys would not believe. Next up, we have the affiliate accounts. So the way the affiliate accounts work is you click on the button, you go to the website, you buy whatever you want, and the website gives me a cut of what you paid. It doesn't cost you anymore, and it doesn't cost a seller anymore. It's just the website giving me a cut for sending you over there to buy stuff. So we have one for Amazon. So if you're wanting to get a hold of any of these cool books that I keep telling you about, or just anything else on Amazon, if you want to do some shopping for your Valentine, since Valentine's Day is coming up, then head on over to Amazon via my affiliate account, and we all win at that point. We have one from mycomicshop.com, so if you're into anything comic books, I would recommend going there. This is where I get all of my comics from, because I don't have time to drive 2 hours out of my way to go to the only brick-and-mortar comic shop I know of within driving distance of my house. So I just go to my comic shop, place my order, and get it delivered right to my door. Very convenient, and there's only been a couple of times I've been looking through their archive or their stock, and they haven't had something that I was looking for. And the packages always arrive just fine and on time. So, highly recommended comic book store. You can get new and used comics. And we have Right Stuff Anime, so if you're interested in anything anime or manga related, then I highly recommend going to Right Stuff Anime and picking up whatever you're looking for. Usually they'll have it. Sometimes their stuff is out of print, or they don't have it in stock or something like that, but usually they've got it. It's very rare that I go looking for something and they don't have a copy of it. They also have shirts and hats and jackets and Dakimakura pillows and Gundam figurines and Nendoroid figurines and soundtrack CDs and
drama CDs and all kinds of other stuff. So if you're looking for anything associated with weeaboo culture, basically, you can go to Right Stuff Anime and get it there. That's where I get all of my manga. That's where I get all of my anime, unless I'm just like in the bookstore one day and happen to see something. Usually I'm getting my stuff from Right Stuff. If you want to advertise on the blog, there are two ways that you can do that. First is Project Wonderful, which isn't the best ad space, but it is there, and you can have an ad on the blog for literally pennies a day. It is a bidding system, and it only lasts for 24 hours, and someone can bid you off of it. So, you know, don't be surprised if that happens. I kind of doubt it will, because my thing has been delisted. But if you want to go over to Project Wonderful and look me up, I am at JimFear138 Audio Productions. Alternatively, if you want to actually get an advertisement on the blog and an ad in the podcast and ads on my social media and me pimping your thing out for $20 a month, you can have all of that and more. For that $20, you will get an ad on the blog right up in the top right-hand corner where everyone will see it as soon as they come to the page. Just like where the Pulp Rev sampler is right now, which I need to take that down because their time is up. But right where the Pulp Rev sampler is, that's about where your ad will be. You will also get an ad in the ad roll, the sponsor roll on the podcast right here. And I will make advertisements for my social media accounts, and I will retweet, reblog, regab, remind, whatever, over the course of the month. If you want, I will also do audio and video ads for your thing that we can put up on various blogs or podcast feeds or YouTube channels or BitChute or Dailymotion, what have you. So just get in touch if you have a thing that you would like to advertise on the blog, and I would be more than happy to pimp the absolute hell out of it. Next up, we have the Bandcamp. The Bandcamp is where I am putting original narrations, so if you want to hear what I sound like now when I'm doing an audiobook, then that's a good place to go and take a look. I have a couple of stories up there, as well as some older stuff from like 2014, but more is coming, so watch that space. And that's about it. That's about it for the, I'm shutting down audio commissions for right now. I'm just like, we're not available right now for that. I'm swamped. I'm too busy. I have to go and finish the stuff before I can take on more jobs. This is something that I should have done last year, but unfortunately I'm new at this. So, audio commissions are closed for right now, hopefully to reopen soon. But all right. Thank you everybody for listening. And thank you to Daddy Warpig for coming on the podcast and having this discussion with me. And like I said, if there's something that you want to talk about on the podcast, just get in touch one way or the other, and we can have a discussion about it for just about however long you want to go. So thanks everybody again for listening, and I'll catch you all next week. Peace out.